This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Stacey Lynn in Washington. What's behind all this excessive heat? CBS's Manuel Bohorquez with the sweltering details.
Scientist Amy Clement with the University of Miami says the heat waves are becoming even more serious the warmer the planet gets.
This trend is not going to reverse on its own, and it won't reverse in the coming years.
Clement says two key things need to be done to try to minimize the impact. One is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The other is to prepare communities for heat waves that could occur more often but also last longer.
There are now 6 confirmed cases of malaria in Florida and 1 in Texas. Dr. Rajiv Chowdhury with Florida International University.
Climate change has an impact on the malarial drugs and the insecticides resistance, and that means that our main malaria tools might be a bit less effective due to climate change.
The U.S. has agreed to supply controversial cluster bombs to Ukraine to defend itself against Russia. More than 120 countries have banned them over concerns about potential harm to civilians. President Biden defended his decision on CNN.
Not an easy decision, and we're not signatories to that agreement, but it took me a while to be convinced to do it.
Mary Wareham with Human Rights Watch calls the decision
disappointing to see the U.S. condemn Syria's use of cluster munitions, to condemn Russia's use of cluster munitions, but then all of a sudden turn around and say, okay, well, we're going to provide cluster munitions to Ukraine.
Humanitarian organizations are urging governments around the world to step in and help Sudan. Correspondent Allison Keyes has details.
Since rival factions began fighting in April, millions have been caught in the middle inside Darfur. IRG Sally Anyanga says the situation is increasingly dire.
Millions of people have been trapped in their houses, unable to leave. We have thousands who have died.
It is difficult to get food. There's little access to clean water, and she says
the health system is almost collapsed.
You can hear the full interview on the CBS News Roundup podcast. The gunman who killed 23 at an El Paso Walmart in 2019 got 90 consecutive life sentences. Here's reporter Chris Fox.
It came after 2 days of victim impact statements from the families. Amaris Vega lost her aunt, Teresa Sanchez.
He wanted to get rid of the Hispanic people here in El Paso, but he didn't do that. He failed, and he didn't win. We're still here, and we're not going anywhere.
Here's a good reason maybe to skip that donut today. Obesity used to be linked to 13 different cancers, but now a new study shows that number's close to 18. And the ages at risk are getting younger, between 18 and 40. This is CBS News.
Find great hires fast with Indeed. Their end-to-end hiring solution makes it easy to attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Military veterans.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. There is a bill in Congress to help give rural communities a better chance at getting federal money they normally don't get because of competition from bigger cities. Mark Moran has more now on the Rebuild Rural America Act.
Senators in Washington, D.C. want to see a $50 billion infusion into America's rural areas. The legislation is written to address rural America's unique challenges and would make it easier for smaller towns and counties to access federal grant money for desperately needed projects, from upgrading roads and bridges to fixing schools and providing broadband internet. Annie Contractor with the nonprofit RuralOrganizing.org says this funding would ignite an economic comeback in parts of the country that often have a hard time competing for federal funds.
Block grant funding, which would deliver funding directly to rural communities, is really important for an equitable distribution of those tax-funded programs that are meant to help communities thrive.
RuralOrganizing.org says 8 out of 10 distressed communities are rural, and 60% of residents in those areas are people of color. Contractor says local flexibility is a crucial piece of the proposal, which would allow town and county leaders to design programs they know will help their specific communities.
Anything from child care systems or subsidization to infrastructure like water or roads, And that's really important because every rural community is different.
She adds the Rebuild Rural America measure would build on investments the Biden administration has already made in rural parts of the country with the Inflation Reduction Act. The bill hasn't yet been assigned to a committee. I'm Mark Moran.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
The RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight. The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know what's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org/empowerwomenvets.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
What is the grand prize? Is it a fabulous cash prize?
You definitely get to take home the cheese. I know
would
that.
I hope so. Humans aren't necessarily logical creatures. Maybe it is.
Thrill-seeking.
It's the thrill of the cheese and the bragging rights.
The first person across the line wins and gets to keep the cheese.
And that's it.
And I think that's it.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Bry. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning and welcome back to this, our second hour here on Morning Cannolis, which as always is our analysis, our review, our discussion of the major stories that animate our lives these days. And this week, like the previous two broadcasts, we're talking about the Supreme Court, much in the news these days. Right before the top of the hour break, chatting in particular about the independent state legislature theory and in discussion with one of my good callers here named Joe from Madison, who raised the first question about whether or not this thing, this what I describe as this ridiculous and scary concept, could resurface. And the answer, Joe, is yes, it could. In fact, there's an attorney general out there who at the time that this matter was still pending before the Supreme Court announced that regardless of how this plays out, he would be pursuing this in his state and perhaps other places around the country. And again, I think your good comment, Joe, about this is that we did have four justices who agreed to hear it in the first place. Rather than leaving it at the North Carolina Supreme Court, which took care of it decisively, talked about this idea of it's being repugnant to the sovereignty of the states, producing absurd, dangerous consequences, could have left it there. But the Supreme Court, four members decided to take this on. Thankfully, six of them in the end decided it was indeed on the dung heap of legal theories and should remain there. But the concern is twofold. Joe, you identified one of them, which is that it could come back in another forum, in some other way. And if indeed the Supreme Court decides it wants to revisit this in some way, shape, or form, perhaps for a while we've gotten a reprieve here, but could happen. And again, we've got this language inside this Moore versus Harper decision that indicates that the federal courts themselves could intervene, as they have done before, to overturn state courts when it comes to some issues that might, in the Supreme Court's view, be beyond their purview, the state Supreme Court purview, to decide. So again, some reasons to be concerned. And Joe, your issue about it resurfacing again is not an unreal one. It's much alive. Joe, we appreciate your staying with me over the break here, remaining with me on the show. Thank you for your continuing patience here this morning. In addition to that observation, you had a second question or observation, which I'd be delighted to hear and entertain.
I do have to say that your language when you described the independent legislature theory as ridiculous and scary was really concise and to the point. And I also, just in this last conversation, you referred to this as the dung heap of legal theories. And I think that was also quite to the point. And in terms of being quite to the point, I wanted the second question I had. The caller, Jack, was talking about the corruption in the Supreme Court and what to do about it in terms of expanding the court or impeachment, whatever. And in the course of his conversation, he used the expression, he said, you can't fire him. And I thought, why not? These are federal employees that are getting our tax dollars to perform a job for us.
us, the people of the country. And if what they are doing is corrupt, and it is corrupt, if you take money from somebody and then you rule on whether that person's, you know, court case is a plus or a minus, that's corrupt. Is there not any way that a state attorney general or people with standing could I don't know, bring charges or sue? It just seems that to say you can't fire them, I guess I'm looking at that and thinking, wow, why not?
Yes,
if they are not performing their job by because of their corruption. So if you would expand on that, I would really appreciate your help and my figuring that out. Thank you.
Joe, as always, insightful, thoughtful, not just rhetorical questions, right? If we are disappointed with the actions of our Supreme Court, and as I said, as you've said, others said, as Mark said earlier on, looking at these decisions and seeing that they are not only products of a time long gone, but Joe, to your point and Mark's point as well, may also be the result of inappropriate bias, corruption, perhaps with a small c. We know from Clarence Thomas that he has been presiding over cases in which his wife has plainly some interests having to do with the 2020 election. Clarence Thomas making decisions about the course of the 2020 election investigation, whether or not subpoenas should be honored. Those are the kinds of things that his spouse, the person who's his partner in life, has also been advocating for, much involved with the very players who are petitioners before the Supreme Court. That issue is out there. We know as well that with respect to Harlan Crow, again, at least one case involving Trammell Crow also involved the Supreme Court, and that Clarence Thomas voted on that. Again, not changing the result in that case, but that's the kind of thing that prompts people to have a lack of respect for, a lack of confidence in the decisions made. Again, we've got Sam Alito, likewise, taking these vacations, and there, once again, we've got clarity that the Supreme Court, at the same time that Sam Alito has this affiliation, going on these vacations, a $100,000 trip to Alaska, deciding a case that results in a substantial verdict, ultimately, in excess of $2 billion in favor of one of the participants in that very lawsuit. That's the kind of thing, again, Joe, to your very good point, that prompts people to say this is more than just a difference of opinion about how to interpret, say, the Voting Rights Act or the Clean Water Act or the Constitution or the Elections Clause, all these kinds of things. If we were to do that, and again, as a 30-year, actually more than that, almost 35 years as a federal employee, I took an oath of office when I was working for a federal judge, when I was in Washington, D.C., working for a time on Capitol Hill, believe it or not, when I was very, very young, certainly as an assistant U.S. attorney, as a U.S. attorney, I took an oath of office that was a predicate for my job, continuing my employment there, the decisions I would make, the recommendations I would make to my bosses, the decisions, the choices that I would make about prosecutions when I was the U.S. attorney, the chief federal law enforcement officer, would not be subject to any personal affiliations, any biases that might be perceived, any financial connections, anything else that would prompt people to think that, gosh, Mr. Santel's decision is not based upon an analysis of the law and the facts, but rather based upon his own personal benefits that might come from that. That would have been a basis to fire me. The Deputy Attorney General certainly would have fired me had that kind of thing happened. And so, Joe, your very good question about, gosh, all of us, all of these folks, federal employees, whether you are working here in the Eastern District or the Western District of Wisconsin or in Washington, D.C., you're ultimately on the employ of the federal government. And should not you be subject to not only an ethics code, but the basic rules and regulations that everyone else is subject to? The issue is not an easy one, again, because our Constitution provides limited remedies. As I said before, we have had one Supreme Court justice who has been impeached. That impeachment process, again, did not result in his removal by the Senate, did not result in his conviction brought principally by the allies of Thomas Jefferson against a fellow named Samuel Chase, probably an inappropriately brought proceeding to impeach and remove him, not removed many, many years ago. But the notion, again, that you're not choosing to act in a way that is consistent with the oath of office and making these affirmative decisions, that goes more centrally to your employment, Joe, the kind of thing you're talking about. Impeachment is certainly out there. Again, you've got to have the appropriate number of votes in the House to return articles of impeachment. You've got to have an appropriate number of votes in the Senate to find a conviction for this kind of conduct. And the question is whether or not America has the political will to respond to this and do more than just doing what I have been doing and you've been doing, others have been doing, which is bemoaning the fact that we do not have a code of ethics. More needs to be expected. There need to be those, again, nonviolent protests, both in the media, before the Supreme Court itself, physically, geographically, there on Capitol Hill, protesting the conduct of Supreme Court justices who plainly should have recused themselves in these cases and therefore have brought this sort of dimension of dismay and disappointment upon the Supreme Court by virtue of their conduct. No easy answers here, Joe. Continued advocacy, a continuing requirement during the course of proceedings to confirm future Supreme Court justices about what they will do, not in specific cases, but the circumstances under which they will recuse themselves, that they will bend over backwards to ensure that there is no suggestion of impropriety in their conduct, that like all other federal employees who take an oath of office, they will do that in furtherance of the rule of law, in furtherance of the Constitution, furtherance of the statutes and the principles and the regulations and directions that animate the agencies and the entities that they for which they are working, that employ them directly. We have a very good comment from Jeff, who's noted from Shorewood, that he also is concerned about this issue and lying during confirmation hearings and focusing in particular upon the fact that during the course of those confirmation hearings, that many of them, all of them, comment upon and their commitment to stare decisis, which is a commitment to the past, appropriately looking back and saying, this is the way the law is. This is the way it is settled. And the notion that at least in recent contemporary times, that commitment not to overturn the foundational things that are founded, well-founded by previous Supreme Courts, well-founded in our Constitution, not situations where you're overturning, say, a Dred Scott or that kind of a thing, but cases where the law is good, it is advancing interests in equal rights and protections, due process in America, those should not be overturned. Jeff making the comment that when our Supreme Court nominees are before the Senate Judiciary Committee, they themselves should be called upon not only to reaffirm that right, but if they do not, in fact, follow it, they should also be called on the carpet for their misbehavior, if you will, their misconduct in failing to follow up on those commitments in their nomination hearings. All of this not easy to wrestle with. A reason to continue to look not only at the substance of what our Supreme Court justices are saying, but also in which the ways in which they behave off the bench. That is the reason why John Roberts, at a minimum, has to establish some new code of ethics. If fails to do so, the Congress, again, this is a matter that Republicans and Democrats alike should be embracing, not because right now there is a majority of the court appointed by Republican presidents, but because they should be independent of politics, and therefore members of the House and the Senate alike should be committed to a Supreme Court that is not violative of these fundamental oath rights and does in fact follow a code of ethics that ensures integrity in their decision making. When we come back, we're not only going to take at least one more caller during the course of this hour, inviting your calls as always at 844-967-2789. We're also going to talk about this issue of standing, which was raised by Mark early on, also repeated by Joe implicitly, if not explicitly, and why also we should take some civics lessons from what the Supreme Court has and has not done in these recent cases. More reasons appropriately to be focused on the decisions of our United States Supreme Court.
Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station.
Tired of hearing only one side of the story? Do you want news and information from people who, like you, know what it's like to work hard every day and still struggle to make ends meet? Then tune in to The Rick Smith Show every weeknight from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Be part of the conversation. Tune in, turn on, and take back the American dream. The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
The Todd Alba Show.
I've been pretty rough on the Joint Finance Committee. I know you're going to give bipartisan praise that you're going to raise the pay for district attorneys and public defenders. You don't get an attaboy for finally saying, we finally heard people cry uncle enough times. You either govern all the time or not once a decade when it's suddenly convenient. So,
but I think we have to at least give people hope once in a while that there is something happening to Madison that is a little bit on the good side.
The Todd Alba Show, weekday afternoons 1 till 3 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Partly sunny with a high near 76 today. An isolated thunderstorm is possible this afternoon. For tonight, mostly clear, lows around 51. Sunny, low 80s on your Sunday. For Sunday night, chance of showers or storms, we'll see a low of 63.
Currently, 69 degrees.
Civic Media radio stations, providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
We are back talking this morning on Morning Cannolis all about the United States Supreme Court, some analysis, some discussions, some observations about this recently completed term, not without its controversy, as was the previous term back in June of last year, a time of announcement of major decisions, again, focusing upon privacy rights, reproductive rights in America, also focusing on guns in America, this case called Bruin that extended for the first time in our nation's history, a right, so-called right, established by the United States Supreme Court under the Second Amendment to carry weapons in public. Never before in our history was that acknowledged. Never before understood as being implicit, if not explicit, in the Second Amendment, changing the way in which we think about firearms in America. As we know, we just came through the celebration of our nation, a wonderful observation of 247 years of our history, that was also pockmarked by at least 17 major shootings in America, mass shootings involving four or more people in the cities around the country. Guns continue to be a major issue, as we've talked about on this show in the past. Also recalling that in the recent past, the Supreme Court has addressed these issues related to the environment. We talked about them in our first hour here this morning, the Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, rolling those back, even though the language of them is fairly clear, rolling back all these kinds of things that have been a part of our tradition for many, many years. And so we appreciate the callers this morning. We appreciate the observations about all of this, historical and also going forward in this segment and going forward. We're also going to do a little bit of civics. We're going to talk about standing. What does that mean? What does damages in a case or controversy mean? And why is that also implicated in at least two, if not three, of these major decisions issued by the Supreme Court in just the past month or so? Standing coming up in our discussion. But before we get to that, another caller on the air. Glad to have you with us again this morning, Mark. Thank you for your observation, your comment, or your question this morning.
Yeah, thank you. It strikes me as remarkable that when Madison pointed out in one of the Federalist Papers that the Congress, when they're setting up the Constitution, didn't assume it to have a complete digest of laws that Congress might have to do to, you know, as in furtherance of the general powers to promote the general welfare. As I would apply that to, in the case of the EPA, that Congress didn't set up so they had a complete list of all the chemicals you can't dump into the environment,
right.
Or all the things they might be required to do to protect the water or protect the air, that they assumed that there'd be experts in subject matter at the various agencies, because it would be impossible to come up with all the possible contingencies they might face to protect the environment. As we've suffered in the past several weeks, the Canadian wildfires, I mean, something that's happened thousands of miles away in some cases has directly impacted people in New York City, for example, or right. in Wisconsin, for example, that the Canadian wildfires affected us here because air was not safe to breathe because of something that was happened in the air, you know, thousands of miles
right,
away.
To our north, right?
That and for water, I mean, that do we have a complete understanding of the hydrologic cycle, that something that might not be connected by surface water, but is certainly connected underneath the ground by the groundwater, and if you dump something there, it shows up someplace else.
Right.
So, I mean, it turns out that what bothers me to some extent is why somebody who is not an expert on the law could actually make a plausible argument before the Supreme Court using the Constitution, using the Federalist Papers, and saying that you guys are making, you know, as Bumble pointed out in Oliver Twist, that they make the law an ass. I mean, that it is just a little different context. But I mean that these guys are, in taking the bribe, for example, as Joel pointed out, he's taking the bribes. I mean, it goes back to antiquity that justice was supposed to be above that kind of thing.
Right, right.
Not supposed to be taking money. And even the appearance of impropriety supposed to be avoided.
Absolutely. And Mark, to your very good point, I think, about delegations of authorities, once again, right? What you're really talking about in the EPA case, actually, the other cases we've chatted about as well, the authorization to the Department of Education, to Homeland Security, all these agencies, we've got this notion in our government, which is implicit in what you've described, the Federalist Papers, this division where Congress passes laws. They're necessarily broad in nature. And then we've got the executive branch. What does the executive branch do? It executes the law, right? It's those are the people who are the experts that you're talking about, who've got the responsibility for understanding in the weeds the specific things. That's the reason why we've got all these different executive agencies doing all these different things. We've got agriculture and labor and plainly justice and state and defense, those kinds of things. But we've got all these different agencies out there, including the EPA, including the Small Business Administration, many other independent agencies that are responsible for doing things with great particularity. And Mark, to your very good point, that's where the experts are, right? That's where the people who know about these things are vested. And we've also got this matter, of course, that's still pending in the Fifth Circuit related to abortion, right? And the drug mifepristone. There again, your very good point, Mark, about the judiciary substituting, if you will, its own view in this case for the decisions of experts, in this case, the FDA making this determination, 23 years of testing in that case, that this drug, for the most part, is safe and secure in handling abortions and handling miscarriages. And now we've got a judge out of Texas and an appeals court that seems to be perched on the decision to find that the expertise inside that agency is not, in fact, to be relied upon and trusted. Interestingly, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit to something that I was going to talk about at the end of this hour. But Mark, your comments are so very, very appropriate, expressing this concern about a division of responsibility and authority, and that is that in the coming Supreme Court term, there is in fact another case coming up called Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo, Raimondo. Remember that case? It's arguably described already as a nuclear bomb inside the administrative state on this very issue. And when we come back after this break, I'm going to tell you about Raimondo and why Mark's comments are presaging what's going to be argued in the Supreme Court, having to do with something called the Chevron Doctrine and deference to agencies. Stay with us for that discussion and more here on our morning broadcast.
the Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.
CBS News Brief. Forecasters warn that much of the South, including Arizona and Florida, is facing serious heat this weekend. Professor Daniel Johnson says,
look in and take care of vulnerable individuals, elderly family members, young children, those with chronic illnesses, and mobility issues are the most susceptible to extreme heat.
President Biden is taking heat over his decision to send cluster bombs to Ukraine in its war with Russia. CBS's Christopher Cruz.
The decision comes just before a NATO summit in Lithuania, where President Biden is likely to face questions from the two-thirds of alliance members who have banned the use of cluster bombs.
A white supremacist who killed 23 people in an attack on Hispanic shoppers in 2019 at an El Paso Walmart has been sentenced to 90 consecutive life sentences. But David Cruz at the League of United Latin American Citizens warns that
there are many more people like him in the making.
He pleaded guilty to avoid the death penalty. CBS News Brief. I'm Allison Keyes.
Here's what you need to know in northwestern Wisconsin. Good afternoon, I'm Jimmy Cuska. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers visited Boys and Girls Clubs across Wisconsin on Thursday to promote his budget signing. Among other things, Evers used his veto pen to increase public school funding for the next 402 years, and Evers said it was important to invest in education for the future.
There's lots of changes that have happened along the way that they need to adapt to, but at the end of the day, they're our future, and having some guarantee that there's going to be some increase 400 years from now, I think that's important.
Republicans are considering a lawsuit over the 402-year budget measure for schools. Howard Markline, the co-chair of the Joint Finance Committee in the state legislature, called Evers' tax priorities misguided and said that the annual increased spending on schools would lead to larger property tax increases. And it should be comfortable weather this weekend if you're heading out on the lake or into the woods. Temperatures will be in the mid-70s to mid-80s with some scattered rain chances throughout the weekend. For Civic Media News, I'm Jimmy Cuska.
It's go time at Chula Vista. Time for you to discover Wisconsin's most complete resort experience. 200,000 square feet of water park fun. New thrills like zip line racing. 18 holes of classic golf. Wisconsin's number one steakhouse. Hundreds of newly renovated rooms. Check it out at ChulaVistaResort.com.
Chula Vista Resort is one of the nation's top 10 indoor water parks per USA Today's 2023 Reader's Choice Awards. Find out why at ChulaVistaResort.com.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Tom from Madtown. Welcome, Tom.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, guys. Heard you talking about Robin Voss, so I called Robin Voss's office and said, yeah, why is DEI so dangerous? And nothing. The guy just stopped talking. I said, hello, are you there? I called him back, and the phone got picked up, and then they didn't say anything. You know, maybe you'll learn something if you listen to The Devil's Advocate.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6
on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
I have Corrine Hendrickson, part of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Action Needed group.
The Joint Finance Committee, again in the middle of the night, took that out and said, well, hey, you have all this money coming from the federal government. Why don't you use that to create this program? Well, guess what? We proved it worked. Wages went up $2 an hour. There actually are a couple extra childcare businesses open now than there were about a year ago, and that's going to stop. Just Monday, we lost two.
Weekday morning, 6 till 8. On your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
93.5. The Tap. 93.5. The Tap.
If only for one night.
We are back. We're talking this morning throughout these 2 hours about our United States Supreme Court. And right before the break, chatting with Mark about his very important and appropriate observation. But what's going on with our courts in America, federal courts in particular, to some extent state courts, but federal courts in the United States Supreme Court specifically, and this notion that the Supreme Court seems more and more in some of these major cases that we have witnessed in recent weeks to be substituting its own self-applied and self-assumed expertise
in areas that are more appropriately left for the executive branch, with the notion that the Congress passes broad laws but cannot possibly, as Mark was just noting, identify every single application of it, and therefore you leave those decisions in the application and the execution to the responsible, the executive branch that knows better how to do these kinds of things. And I was mentioning right before the break that there is a case that's going to be before the Supreme Court in the coming term, 2023-2024, called Raimondo, Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo. We probably won't talk about it again for about another year or so, but it raises this issue very directly. It invites the justices in many ways to overturn what's called the Chevron Doctrine, C-H-E-V-R-O-N. It stems from a 1984 case. So it's been around for a very, very, very long time. Basically, it says this, consistent with Mark's comments, the comments of others throughout our history, that courts should defer to federal agencies' interpretations of ambiguous statutes and even non-ambiguous statutes, as long as those interpretations are reasonable. In other words, if an agency goes off the reservation, does something that's completely untenable, unjustified, that's different. But if you've got a basis to believe that an interpretation and application of the law as established by the Congress is rational and reasonable, you stay away from it. That's the Chevron Doctrine based upon this 1984 case. Deference to the executive branch, a codification in many ways from the notion in our United States Constitution of separation of powers. The court has undeniably been chipping away at that doctrine over in recent years. And two of our justices sitting on the bench right now, their names are Neil Gorsuch, Clarence Thomas, frankly, are probably in what could be called open revolt, okay? Justice Gorsuch wrote just last year this, "At this late hour, the whole project deserves a tombstone no one can miss." He's talking about Chevron and this notion that we defer in appropriate circumstances to the reasonable, rational determinations made by executive branch agencies across the board. That has been our history, certainly in contemporary America, arguably throughout our nation's history. Gorsuch went on to say, "We should acknowledge forthrightly that Chevron did not undo and could not have undone the judicial duty to provide an independent judgment of the law's meaning in the cases that come before the nation's courts." That's a declaration of a great deal of power inside our Supreme Court and the federal courts generally. He goes on to say, this case in particular, Raimondo, by the way, has to do with the Commerce Department and, believe it or not, regulations regarding monitors on fishing vessels. That's how this comes about, whether or not the Commerce Department appropriately is interpreting and applying fishing vessel monitors. Again, something that we would not expect our legislature to be involved in the detail, as Mark just said. That's the kind of thing appropriately delegated to people inside the Commerce Department to regulate. Nonetheless, the Supreme Court is going to take this up. All of what this means is at least four justices want to address this question. Four of them have said, well, maybe we should think again about this deference under Chevron. It would take five of them, as we know, to overturn the 40-year precedent that's out there. That is the history of the court in recent terms, overturning 40 and 50-year precedents. They may do it again. And if the justices do away with Chevron, again, this doctrine that says there's deference, appropriate, reasonable, balanced deference to agencies, it would plainly undermine, further weaken federal agencies to do what they need to do. In what? In areas of the environment, in the areas of commerce and healthcare and education, all these kinds of things appropriately delegated to the executive branch, not without a check and balance. The Congress can come back and pass more legislation. Things can be challenged in court, but with a sense of deference. Why? Because, again, the executive branch develops inside its agencies the expertise to do these kinds of things. Could make it much more difficult for not just this administration, but also future administrations to place in place regulations, particularly, and I'm going to focus again on these environmental matters where Congress has for decades largely failed to pass major laws, right? If you don't do these kinds of things, if you don't do these things in environment, in immigration, another major area where Congress has simply failed to act, under those circumstances, yes, indeed, Homeland Security has to act. Why? Because these major problems are not being addressed. And if the courts come back and say, no, you cannot act in these areas as the courts have done, It plainly establishes a precedent where no branch of government is addressing the major issues of our time. We have seen that not only in the environmental area, we saw that in the past terms in which this Supreme Court prohibited the Biden administration from imposing upon corporations, large corporations, not small mom and pop entities and businesses, but large corporations, the requirement that their employees do what? That they be vaccinated, on the understanding that if you have employees who are not vaccinated, they would be tested reasonably and periodically. What was the purpose behind that? It was based upon expertise, right? That we knew something, not everything, about COVID-19, but we knew that vaccinations assisted and reduced dramatically the numbers of deaths. Plainly in excess of about 1.1 million deaths in America. In the wake of that, the capacity of an executive agency to act, to do what? To benefit all of us, to ensure that we are healthier, more safe and secure than we otherwise would be. Chevron doctrine, if in fact it is rolled back even further, stands to compromise that capacity of our government to act generally, and certainly to have the executive branch do what it needs to do when the congressional branch of government, the legislative branch, is not doing its job, and even when it is doing its job, to do it in a way that ensures that in the weeds on these specific issues, we've got expertise in those areas. Look for argument this coming fall or perhaps beyond in this Raimondo case, Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo. It is focused again upon monitors on fishing vessels, but has much greater implications for all kinds of agencies out there. Major issues addressed by our United States Supreme Court. I promised at the start of our time together this morning that I also comment upon something related to civics. And that is a bit of instruction. We've talked about this issue before. It's standing. And it also comes out of a couple, probably three or four major decisions. In our remaining time this morning, I'm going to highlight just a couple of those and comment on the extent to which this Supreme Court also compromising our sense of what they can and should do is stretching the notion of standing, perhaps even running roughshod completely over standing and the concept that when you go into court, whether it's here in the state of Wisconsin, in our state courts, our federal courts, there's got to be a case or controversy, some argument to be made with an opposing side, and I have to be able to allege in some way that I have suffered some damages. Something has happened to me individually, to my company, to my corporation, to a group that I'm a part of that is cognizable, that I can point to on a chart and say, Judge, Justices, this is the way in which I have been damaged by the conduct of this other party, and that's the reason why we are in court. That's a fundamental notion of standing. It gives me quite literally the capacity to stand up in court and say, Judge, I have been compromised by virtue of something the government has done, something that another party has done in a way that you now need to remedy. A jury needs to remedy. The court needs to remedy, typically, most often, not exclusively, but typically through damages, right? Remedying things through monetary results, sometimes requiring that things be enjoined. Stop that from happening. Stop this bad environmental thing from going forward. Stop some economic or agriculture or educational thing from happening further. That's another possible remedy. But in all those circumstances, my request for relief is premised upon the notion that in some way I've been damaged. And so, let's talk about two of these recent cases. Supreme Court, a little less than 2 weeks ago, ruling that the Biden administration had overstepped, as we now are told by the Supreme Court, had overstepped its authority with its plan to wipe out about $400 billion in student debt. We know this case well. It's been much bandied about. We talked about it at length in our broadcast just last week. Dashing the hopes of tens of millions of borrowers and imposing some new restrictions on this issue we're chatting about right now on presidential power. About 45 million people across the country owe $1.6 trillion in federal loans for the college. This decision, again, a 6-3 decision, finding that the executive branch, the Biden administration, does not have this authority to do what it was attempting to do. Chief Justice, again, writing for the majority, said that a 2003 law, which allows the Secretary of Education, this legislation passed by the Congress, that allows the Secretary of Education to waive or modify relevant statutes and regulations in emergencies, is inapplicable, or at least the Secretary of Education is not properly understanding what that broad conveyance, that conferring of authority means. So the Supreme Court, once again, substituting its view for what the Secretary of Education is delegated to do, not authorizing the administration to cancel this debt. The Supreme Court said the Secretary's plan has modified these provisions. Talk about being in the weeds on something, right? The Secretary's plan, the Supreme Court wrote, has modified these cited provisions only in the same sense that the French Revolution modified the status of French nobility. Again, invoking what's happened in France, obviously its revolution. It followed our own, abolished those, supplanted them with a new regime entirely. Well, again, we can spar about what language means, but undeniably saying that the Biden administration had overreached in this area. And here's the point. Justice Alito Kagan, in her vicious, virulent dissent, along with her other companions on the so-called liberal side of the bench, Sonia Sotomayor and Ketanji Brown Jackson, summarized her dissent from the bench. Again, as I said last week, a fairly rare circumstance, a sign of some very deep and profound, deep-seated disagreement with the majority. She said that in siding with six Republican-led states that sued to block this student loan forgiveness program, the majority was opportunistic, unprincipled, and infected by politics. Again, strong words. But she goes further, and she says, you know what? This case shouldn't be here at all. There's no standing for this case to be here. She said, from the first page to the last, today's opinion departs from the demands of judicial restraint. She's talking about standing. She's talking about this requirement that parties come in when they're able to establish that indeed they have suffered some specific damages. At the behest of a party that has suffered, and here we go, no injury. That is what Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan wrote. At the behest of a party that has suffered no injury, the majority decides a contested public policy issue properly belonging to the politically accountable branches and to the people they represent. In other words, this case shouldn't be here. No damages shown by the particular parties in this case. And again, many people across the board, even before this case was decided, when it was argued way back in the fall of last year, thought, where's the standing here? In particular, focusing upon Missouri, okay? And particularly focusing upon the arguments made at the time about the higher education and the specific trappings of this particular law. And so at the time of this decision, when it was argued again at the time of the oral argument, the justices were focusing on a nonprofit entity that services federal loans. It comes out of the state of Missouri. It's called the Missouri Higher Education Loan Authority. It has the acronym MOHELA, M-O-H-E-L-A, okay? And so during the course of this oral argument, the states had argued that that entity's, and here we go, potential losses, not real losses, suffered from the president's loan forgiveness program were enough. They were enough to confer standing because it is effectively, this MOHELA, effectively is an arm of the state of Missouri. Following all this, it's an arm of the state of Missouri, and it might potentially suffer some losses by virtue of this program being proposed by the president. They also went on to say that the authority might fail to make payments to Missouri. That is, MOHELA might fail to make payments to Missouri if the program is allowed to proceed. All of that I would offer to you suggests no real damages, no real standing. The Chief Justice bought that argument and said, yes, indeed, there's standing here. And again, goes on to find that the president's decision here to go ahead with this program unsupported by the law. When we come back, I'm going to talk more about that case. And then we're also going to talk about the LGBT case coming out of Colorado, likewise, where there's significant reason to believe the court should not have addressed the issue at all based upon a lack of damages and standing before the Supreme Court and before the halls of justice. Stay with us for that further discussion in our last segment here on Morning Cannolis.
If only for one night. If only for one night. Ooh, hey, hey, hey. If only-
One call can do it all. Your business's message can be broadcast across the entire state of Wisconsin through the Civic Media Network of stations, or we can focus the campaign in your hometown. We have the flexibility. You have the control. Civic Media, 608-819-8255.
The Todd Alba Show.
The most elitist scorn towards average people exists within sort of that conservative far-right ecosystem.
We're a couple of dudes who used to be Republicans. We were Dwight Eisenhower, Ronald Reagan, Tommy Thompson, Scott Klug Republicans. This Republican Party you got now with Robin Voss and Devin Lemieux, the Republican Party at the top, want to start banning books, for God's sake.
Weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app, the Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
When you take the iconic Wienermobile and you call it the Frankmobile, come on, that is terrible.
The Kraft Heinz Company announced the name change to celebrate the brand's 100% beef franks as the company debuts a new recipe. Well, no more lips and other things, I guess.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Hey, son, how are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it.
When your kid can't find the language, find the lyrics. Start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ad Council and Pivotal Ventures.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Partly sunny with a high near 76 today. An isolated thunderstorm is possible this afternoon. For tonight, mostly clear, lows around 51. Sunny, low 80s on your Sunday. For Sunday night, chance of showers or storms, we'll see a low of 63.
Currently, 69 degrees.
Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
We're back in this final segment this morning. Morning Cannoli is talking about all things Supreme Court and doing this civics portion, which I promised my producer, Anya, I would do. She's a student of civics, a great student of civics, and also focused on standing. So we're talking this morning in support of Anya's great interest in this about standing and my observations, along with that of the minority on the Supreme Court. In at least two of these cases, the United States Supreme Court has run roughshod over this concept. Before you go into a court, you need to have standing, some basis to claim legitimately that you have suffered something. In this case involving the invalidation of the president's policies and his plan to forgive millions of dollars of loans for students who still have these debts out there, Justice Kagan questioned exactly this. And she said, in connection with her dissent to all of this, in giving these states a forum, in particular Missouri, which through this MOHELA might in fact suffer some damages if in fact there are failures to make payments, if in fact the program is allowed to proceed, all these hypotheticals, she says, in giving these states a forum, in adjudicating their complaint, the court forgets its proper role. This is Elena Kagan writing once again. The court acts as if it is an arbiter of political and policy disputes rather than of cases and controversies. Again, this notion that before you go into court, I've got to have some cognizable reason to say I was harmed, something happened, and there is a challenge that needs to be resolved here. Deciding this case, she said, blows through a constitutional guardrail intended to keep courts acting like courts, adjudicating real cases and not things that are hypothetical or made up. It is fair to say, as many others who are much more attentive to these things than I have been throughout my history and certainly much more learned in the area of constitutional law, the Supreme Court has identified in cases where standing is much more compelling a decision not to acknowledge standing. In other words, under facts and circumstances where the damage is far more clear, they have declined to find standing. And so in this case, bending over backwards, Chief Justice John Roberts, to invalidate again, as Elena Kagan said, on policy grounds, a circumstance where the petitioning party, Missouri, through MOHELA, doesn't even allege a specific harm or violation. It's also been commented, of course, both before and after the rendition of this opinion, that an awful lot of this sounds like because there were some benefits here,
some people who may have gotten benefits through this program that I or others who paid off their loans did not get, that therefore I'm damaged by virtue of somebody else getting something. That also not a basis for establishing standing. Maybe it's appropriate to have that discussion in policy considerations, but not in the context of this jurisprudential issue. It also comes up in at least one other major case, which we've also talked about. That is a Supreme Court case in which it backed this web designer who was opposed to same-sex marriages. And again, a Supreme Court says about a week or so ago that this website designer, name was Lori Smith, had a First Amendment right to refuse to design wedding websites for same-sex couples despite a state law that prohibits discrimination against gay people. And Neil Gorsuch, interestingly, writing for a 6-3 majority, says that the First Amendment protected that designer from being compelled to express views she opposed. Lots and lots of reaction to that, of course, on this broadcast and in others. Let's focus upon the standing issue once again. That Colorado law, of course, forbids discrimination against gay people by businesses open to the public, as well as some statements announcing that discrimination. That's very basically what the Colorado state law says. Ms. Smith, Lori Smith, has said that her Christian faith requires her to turn away same-sex couple seeking website design services. And here's the point. She has not yet begun her wedding business. She's not yet up in operation. She probably is now in the wake of the Supreme Court decision. Nor has she posted anything on her website, a statement of her current website about her policy and beliefs, for fear, she said, of running afoul of the law. So she sued to challenge it, saying that it violated her rights anticipatorily, her rights to free speech and free exercise of religion, although, again, the Supreme Court did not cast it in a religious bent, if you will. She has not in this situation been specifically damaged by any particular imposition and enforcement of the law. She is simply saying that I might, in fact, be harmed by it. And I would offer, as again, the minority says, there's no standing here. You haven't alleged damages in particular. The case is at best premature. The fact that she has not yet posted things on her website, but that she is afraid of the imposition of this, is not a basis for federal courts or state courts under basic standing principles to exercise its review, its authority over something like this. And so once again, we've got this Supreme Court deciding to pluck out of all the cases it can decide this case in a situation where standing is not only questionable, but probably not existent at all. And so in this case, once again, we've got reason to be concerned that the Supreme Court doing some policy creation here in a situation where it should not be involved from the first stop. The situation involving this particular website designer is complicated by the fact that even while this case was going up to the Supreme Court, and certainly since the time that it was rendered, the decision was perhaps sullied, if you will, by the fact that there was reference in 2016, according to the website designer, that a gay man named Stuart had requested her services for help with this upcoming wedding. Said, "We are getting married early next year and would love someone to design work for our invites, placements, etc. We might also stretch to a website," all that about the message that he apparently set through a website. And so in court filings, her lawyers produced a copy of that inquiry to show that, yes, indeed, this contest is real, that she's really facing this challenge. And the problem with this, of course, also in the news, also in the wake of this decision by the Supreme Court to address the case in the first place, is that Stuart, who requested his last name not be withheld, said in an interview with major media that he never sent that message, even though it correctly lists his email and telephone number. He also said he's been happily married to a woman for the last 15 years and that none of this is real. In fact, until he received a call from a reporter indicating that he has been identified as the reason why Ms. Smith might be concerned about this, he said this. He can confirm that I did not contact this agency about a website. It's fraudulent in so much as someone is pretending to be me and looking to marry someone called Mike. That's not me. And so, again, it is a footnote to this standing issue that, again, probably not at the core of the Supreme Court's ruling. They plainly were going to go ahead and decide this case. But when you look at issues about damages, the very thing that her attorneys in the lower courts pointed to as a reason for being concerned about this, turns out it's not true at all. A reason to be concerned about the going into court when damages are suffered, and legitimate courts can therefore address the cases and controversies that are properly before it. In the next broadcast on this broadcast show, we're going to chat more about the Supreme Court, cases coming up in its next term, and also talk more generally about the rule of law in America, the importance of the administration of justice, and government, its role that it plays in all of our lives. Stay with us. Join us again next week for that discussion right here on Morning Cannolis. Thank you so much for joining me this morning on July 8th. Looking forward to your further contributions, comments, questions, and observations about life in America and the aspiration for justice in it.
The Devil's Advocates Radio.
The entire light beer industry is under attack from the right at this time. Apparently, that they no longer have women in bikinis selling the beer.
I would suggest, and this is on the Fox Entertainment Network.
I believe it's the Fox News. Well,
well, I just hope I don't get to the Captain Morgan and Diet Cokes, man. That'd be a sad day.
The Devil's Advocates Radio with Dom and Kroot. Weekdays 4 till 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. It's never personal, only politics. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show with Dom and Kroot. Weekdays from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. This is 93.5 The Tap. 93.5 The Tap.